Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
More news, Manus, out of our good friends at Tesla. Tesla cuts roughly 40-person growth content advertising team. So they're eliminating the marketing team as part of those layoffs. That's according to people familiar with the matter here. Stock off 4% today, 52-week low, down 43% year-to-date. Let's check in with Steve Mann. He's a global autos analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. He joins us from the Princeton campus, and I mean campus down there. It is beautiful down there in Princeton. That's kind of where we got a lot of the Bloomberg Intelligence folks housed down there. Steve, this is brutal here. Let's start with something basic, which is really the fundamental issue here, which is pricing. Mr. Musk cut prices again. If he wakes up on the wrong side of the bed, does he cut prices? What's going on with the pricing at Tesla these days?
There's a lot of things going on at Tesla right now. Brutal is probably not, that's mildly calling it. We always thought that they will have to reverse prices. We're not sure why, early in the year they increased prices. Prices have been dropped in the U.S. Prices over the weekend has been dropped in China. China is a quite different market. It's hyper competitive. Everybody's cutting prices, especially BYD early in the year and late last year. So we're not surprised they're going to cut prices. The question is, where are the earnings going to be? And there's going to be a lot of questions that Elon Musk has to answer tomorrow at their earnings call.
Yep, Wedbush Securities were with me a couple of weeks ago, and they said it's a Hurricane 5 storm coming towards them. That's gone from a Cinderella story to that. But who, if you look at BYD, if you look at Li, and you look at Tesla, they're all cutting prices. So is this the bottom of that cycle? Has Tesla got the capacity to weather a price-cutting storm in China?
That's a good question. I don't think it's the end of it. We're actually seeing second quarter sales to be, probably the same as what we saw in the first quarter. And remember, first quarter, Tesla actually, and the industry itself, actually show slower growth and even some declines for certain automakers like Tesla. So, second quarter is not going to be pretty as well. And I think Tesla, fortunately for them, they are still the only profitable EV maker in the industry right now. They have about 17% gross margin compared to Ford and GM. They're at high single digit. So they do have some room to give, and I think part of it is really they're really hoping, Tesla is really hoping to drive more volume, generate more cash. And one of the things that they want to get to sooner rather than later is really to monetize that robotaxi, all the investment they've made in AI and autonomous vehicles.
Gross margin of 70%, is that just on the manufacturing side, or is that with the credits and so on and so forth? Because my question is, if they start cutting prices, are they going to sacrifice unit profitability?
Yeah, the 17% is on the automotive side. We're hoping they don't cut more prices because 17% is not as good as the mid 20% they were getting last year and the year before. And cutting prices is not the solution. The industry does not need to be in that spiral of cutting tit for tat price cuts. It's going to hurt everyone, and at the same time, it's going to hurt, the GMs and Ford, because it doesn't really make it you know, feasible even for them to roll out a cheaper model down the road. So, you know, what we're trying to do is create greater adoption in the EV market, in the EV industry, for every consumer. And cutting prices is going to, you know, weed out a lot of the competition that are actually trying to introduce a more affordable model for the market, for the greater market.
Steve, I mean, we can debate adoptability in China and the United States of America forever. I mean, the infrastructure is, one could coin a phrase, probably not there. Again, going back to a Wedbush note delivered in my inbox this morning by Dan Ives, which is, it comes down to delivering a Model 2 in the next 12 to 18 months to deliver a second wave of growth. If they don't deliver a new Model 2, that growth will not come, and robo-taxis would be a tragic gamble, in our opinion, as full autonomy we do not see until 2030. This comes down to innovation in Model 2 at the base, doesn't it?
Yeah, Model 2 is important. I think what the industry is looking for and what investors are looking for is they're looking for more affordable models for consumers, so that the penetration rate, so the addressable market for EV actually, it's going to be greater than what it is today. Now, like I said earlier, Tesla, it has been aggressive, probably the most aggressive in cutting EV prices. And they've redesigned a vehicle that they can manufacture at a lower cost than, you know, than it is today. So, you know, they could launch a Model 2. The other option, you know, I don't think the market has really talked about is, you know, the price cutting will allow them the cost cutting will probably allow them to cut prices even further. You know, it wouldn't be a surprise down the road that they're going to offer the Model 3 below $30,000. You know, if they can manage that cost wisely.
Hey, Steve, after the close tomorrow, Tesla will report numbers. They have a conference call 5:30 p.m. Wall Street time. What does Elon Musk need? What message does he need to get across to kind of, you know, shore up this stock price here?
Well, as you know, the stock price is, you know, mostly driven by the anticipation of robotaxi, of autonomous vehicle, of AI. I think what he really needs to come out and tell people, give certain milestones for the investors to follow, to understand, you know, how he's taking that company forward into, you know, into the next decade. Right? How is Robotaxi is going to generate the revenue and the profit that he's so much been advocating for? So, you know, automotive business, we all know it's a small part. It's in terms of valuation. But they, you know, I think Elon Musk and the company really needs to come out to make the investor feel comfortable that he is still on track and there is a light at the end of the tunnel, sooner rather than later.
Is there a sense that he's focused enough on this company here? Is there still that concern that he spread too thin, do you think?
I don't think so. I think, you know, he's one person. I mean, he's done a lot with SpaceX. He's done a lot with Tesla, obviously, and I think he's, even though there's been some departure, he still has a very, very strong team behind him. He's still hiring a lot for the AI, for the autonomous vehicle business. So I'm not too concerned at the moment. I think communication is key for the company in the next, you know, tomorrow, in the next few weeks,
yep,
and through August 8th when he actually reveals his robotaxi.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'm going to listen to this call tomorrow. So that'll be interesting. I think a lot of people are going to pay attention to that call. Steve, yes. Thanks so much for joining us. Steve Mann, Global Autos and Industrials Research Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us in Princeton, New Jersey via Zoom. And here it's, you know, as Dan Ives of Wedbush said, this is a critical, maybe the most important conference call for Elon Musk here, because there is a whole host of headwinds for this company.
It's about reinstilling confidence.
Yep.
It's confidence in genius. I never said the genius had left.
Right. No, exactly right. So we'll see that Tesla again. 52-week low here today, off about 45% just year to date. Significant loss of value there.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Right smack in the middle of earnings season, Manus. Verizon Communications. I'm a customer of Verizon Wireless. You know,
I think I am as well. Yes, I am,
you know,
Verizon.
I've cut my kids off just about everywhere financially. They're pretty much on their own, with one glaring exception: the cellular telephone bill. They're all still on this whole family plan. I'm carrying all of them. So I haven't figured out how to get rid of them. Maybe that helped with Verizon's earnings here. John Butler joins us. He covers all things telecom for Bloomberg Intelligence. He's here in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. He doesn't mail it in like some of his managers do. He comes into the New York office, which we appreciate. John, what did you see from Verizon this quarter?
So, Paul, I thought overall a very solid quarter from Verizon. I mean, one thing that I always look at is pricing, right? Because when they raise prices, which they did on me and you, by the way,
I didn't see that.
It extends across the whole base, their base of 100 million plus subscribers. So pricing was up strongly in the quarter. And I thought overall a solid quarter. I mean, it's interesting because the telecoms throw all these metrics at you, and you can always point to one or two and say they were weak here, they were strong there, you know, and it all comes out in the wash, in my opinion. I take that 10,000 foot view and I say, how is pricing and how were subscriber net adds? How many net new subscribers did they add? And they're still a share donor. They're still losing a bit of subscribers on the margin, but every quarter they're getting better and better. So on balance, I thought a decent quarter in terms of the trends. And, you know, I like where they're headed for the year.
I remember when we used to try to get used to acronyms when we were covering Vodafone and different things in Europe. You know, you've got your average revenue per user. But
right.
You look at the, you just switch on your television at home and you've got Apple, you've got Netflix, you've got Prime, and you're just consuming so much more at so much more a faster speed. So where are they in terms of pricing differential for that additional bandwidth that I'm going to use more of? It's just a natural evolution of gorging on data.
Well, I'm glad you asked that, Manus, because what Verizon is doing so well is they've come out with a new family of unlimited plans called My Plan, and it allows people to not only buy wireless service, but also the streaming services at a pretty good deal.
So it's finally, there's a bundle.
Right. There is a bundle.
Praise!
And you get to control the bundle. So they don't set preset bundles and say you can get plan A, B, or C. You can sort of mix and match and say, I want wireless service and I want Disney, but not Hulu. So you can sort of customize the plan yourself, ergo the name My Plan. And it's resonating really well. Like, I'm really surprised after about a year, they've got a quarter of the base on My Plan. It's very good for them because they're highly profitable plans. And by year end, they hope to have half the base on that My Plan structure, which is big.
You know, I'm looking at the stock here, off about 2.5% today, but up about 5% year to date. This thing's got a 6.5% dividend yield. That's what I'm talking about.
I know.
So I don't know why you can't talk to your good. I saw Tim Cook at Duke recently, and I said, can you raise your dividend a little bit? And he gave me the Heisman. But 6% dividend, 7% dividend yield.
Yeah.
Is that sustainable for these guys?
You know, I think most telecoms know the danger of cutting a dividend.
Yep.
So let's put it that way. But if you look at Verizon stock, you touched on it, it's had a bit of a run here. And so as that stock price goes up, obviously the yield goes down. But, you know, they're very focused on shareholder returns as they mature here. AT&T is the same way. So is T-Mobile. And so in terms of the dividend, I think it's very safe for right now.
You see, you use the word maturity, and that brings a lot of connotations, and one of them is M&A. You remember the most fabled disaster telecoms merger of all time, AT and what was it, AOL, Time Warner. But when you use the word maturity.
Got paid on that, thank you.
Woo!
Yeah, we got paid.
Yeah, good for you.
There you go.
We represent AOL.
We represent, but you know what, but there's the question, is the next iteration in this market some form of M&A, or is it innovation?
So they got asked that in the call, and I thought the answer was very good, which is we have the assets in place right now to execute on the growth plan that we see for the next few years. And I think that's right. But they also have the ability, if they want, to make either tuck-in acquisitions
He wants dividends. He wants dividends rather than tuck-in acquisitions.
I think they know that investors want that dividend. So in terms of any grand ambitious M&A like we saw with AT&T and Time Warner, I'm not seeing it with Verizon.
What's the competitive landscape these days? Is it just price?
It is very tough. At the low end, it's all about price. At the higher end, which is where Verizon plays, it's all about value. What kind of value are you offering with that package? And I think we were talking about Verizon's My Plan, the mix and match. That has high value. And I think it's resonating well with the subscriber base.
All right. Very good. John Butler, he is our go-to guy on all things telecom. Verizon putting out some numbers here. Decent numbers. Stock off a couple of percent today. John Butler covers telecom for Bloomberg Intelligence. We appreciate getting some of his time.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
So my tech M&A bankers are not happy because apparently Salesforce takeover talks with Informatica are cooling off. And that might have been a nice M&A trade in the tech space. Let's break it down a little bit here. Anurag Rana, senior technology analyst. You know him. He's out in Chicago. This guy I don't know, Sunil Rajgopal, senior software analyst. But the good news is he's in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. He doesn't mail it in from Chicago like Anurag Rana does. Anurag, I didn't hire this guy, Rajgopal, did I? I don't know him.
No, Sunil's awesome, and he does all thing infrastructure. You'll really like him.
Good stuff. Well, at least he's here and in the office. We make note of that. All right, so Anurag, I was kind of surprised to see this news to begin with. Like, I didn't think Salesforce needed to really buy anything. So what's going on here, do you think?
Yeah, it was just a big head-scratcher for us, too, almost a few days ago, because last March, Benioff comes and says, I've disbanded the M&A committee, no more M&A. I'm going to focus on margins and organic growth. And in less than a year, you know, or you know, just around that 1 year mark, he's like, oh, we're going to go back and, you know, buy something. Now, he didn't say that. The company didn't say that. But that was the rumor on the street that they're looking to buy Informatica. For us, that was a bit of a surprise because Informatica grows 6 to 7% compared to Salesforce, which is growing north of 10%. So why would anybody buy something that is slow growth? I get the data angle of it, but, you know, it was not something that we really liked.
Sunil, first of all, thanks so much for joining us here in studio. Sunil Rajgopal, senior software analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. Tell us about Informatica. I don't know a lot about it. I don't think a lot of investors know a lot about it. And that was one of the reasons that they're saying, what is Salesforce buying here? Or maybe thinking about buying? Tell us about this company.
Sure. Informatica is all about data management, which is about cleaning all the data that comes from different sources and aligning it with the applications and getting all things sorted out for data. So data comes in various shapes, forms, and different sources. So all of that needs to be cleaned up to be used in a proper shape. So I think Informatica is that layer that acts as a cleanser of data and gets you to that right usage. So that's where it comes in as a player.
So if they're not going to tie up with Salesforce, what's the call on this company? What's the call on the stock, either, you know, bullish or bearish?
Look, strategically for Informatica, such an alliance would have been a great move that would have helped fuel its cloud journey, and that now accounts for roughly 1/3 of its revenues. With the deal not happening, Informatica now has to focus on fueling its cloud growth organically. The company is boosting its partnership and rolling out new AI-powered features. But this space is highly fragmented and competitive. The company has continued to lose market share, especially with the challengers that have risen substantially over the last few years. There are other big players like SAP and IBM that also compete. So I think going forward, the market will definitely look a lot more challenging because now Salesforce are not having to go through with this deal will put more resources into MuleSoft, which I think will raise the competitive intensity. And I think that is a big challenge for Informatica going forward.
Anurag, on your side, from the Salesforce side, I mean, is it just steady as she goes? I mean, it's just such a great company. What's the call for the next 12 to 18 months for Salesforce.com?
So, Paul, what we're thinking, you know, hopefully by the end of this year, we get a little more clarity on technology spending. And perhaps from next year onwards, we can see that, you know, low double-digit growth in earnings, as well as, I take that back, low double-digit growth in sales, coupled with some margin expansion, getting you to that mid to high teens earnings growth. That's what we want from Salesforce, organic growth, organic earnings, not so much driven by M&A. And I'm hoping that that's what the company delivers.
Sunil, on the software side, what are the most exciting areas for you that you're looking at here?
Look, for me, in the overall enterprise software space, I still like names in the observability sector.
The observability?
Yeah,
what's observability. Observability?
All right. So the observability is they act as a layer that monitors all of your systems, applications. So be it any kind of an application that you run in your enterprise, everything needs to be monitored if there are like any bugs, if there are like system downtimes, etc. So observability vendors typically monitor all your applications and the infrastructure. So they play a very critical role in the overall enterprise software space. And I think players such as Datadog, Dynatrace are very well positioned.
Did that come public recently, like recently, last couple of years?
Yeah, yes, that's right.
So what is, I mean, I love the name. I'm looking at the stock here. I'm bringing up the stock Datadog. The symbol is DDOG. It seems kind of $40 billion market cap. It's kind of flat stock price on the year, but up 75% over the trailing 12 months. What's the call on Datadog here?
Look, it's a very, I would say it has been a fast-growing company. And of course, last year we have seen a slowdown in the overall enterprise software space. And Datadog, of course, has been impacted with that slow IT spending trends. But overall, if you look at the observability space, as we see, I think that is a space that will continue to grow because of the number of applications and the infrastructure that enterprises are deploying, especially with what is supposed to come with Gen AI and others. We will continue to see a massive rise in the infrastructure and applications, and that should all bode well for Datadog and players such as Dynatrace and others in the observability space.
Anurag, we've gotten earnings coming up for the tech names. What are you looking for here? Should we be just kind of seeing count how many times they mention AI on the conference call?
Yeah, a little bit of that. I think it's going to be a steady growth rate, but I'm getting a little concerned about the guidance because I think the macro environment is getting a little bit dicey, not sure what's going to happen in the Middle East. So I'll be very surprised if any company comes up with a bullish guidance. But I think one should be prepared for it because we have seen some of these names go up pretty strong over the last 12 months. So there could be a period of consolidation for the next quarter or two. Our big call is that we do see tech spending recovery, perhaps now in the later half of the year into next year, but we don't want any one of that to be delayed. So not baking any massive positive surprises over the next quarter or two, but hoping for a rebound by the end of the year.
There's no declines here, let's be clear. It's just a question, what is the growth rate in tech spending? So just give us an eyeball kind of where we are now, where it has been, and where do you think it could go?
So let's talk about, for example, I'll throw out a number, AWS constant currency growth rate. That's a big leading indicator of what's happening. Last quarter, it was 13% in constant currency, the quarter before that 12, and the quarter before that 12. We think this time it comes to around 14, 15, but next quarter again, it comes to in that same range of about 14 to 15, because now we are looking at stabilization of the growth rates, but we do expect that to pick up by the end of the year. You can correlate that for any company, whether it's Salesforce, whether it's Microsoft, Azure growth rate, a similar chart in the rate of growth of the growth rates rather than anything else. And that's why I'm saying the next quarter or two is where we see stabilization in that rather than a big leg up.
So Neil, in your software space where you play, Are your companies trying to glom onto the AI trend? And if so, how are they doing it?
Look, I think most of the companies that I cover are in the initial phase of this AI wave, and most of them are piloting new products, bringing up features like Copilot and others. But one interesting fact that Datadog pointed out very recently is that 3% or so of their ARR is being driven by this Gen AI focused companies, which is interesting that you're still in very early stages, and I think that will be a momentum that will continue to grow.
Are we going to get, Sunil, do you think, like I came up when the internet first started, you had companies come public that were internet names, whether it was America Online, whether it was Google for search, Facebook for social, you had companies that defined or helped define, and then so simple people like me could say, oh, if I want exposure to the internet, I can go by Google or by Facebook if I want social. Are we going to have AI-specific companies coming public, do you think?
I think that's a move that everyone is watching. Of course, we have companies like OpenAI and others that are potentially growing in size and have a massive amount of, users, et cetera. So that's a market that will continue to be on watch out. And there are a number of other smaller companies that are coming up in the AI space. I think over the course of next 12 months, we will see a lot of them in the market.
All right, good stuff. Sunil Rajagopal, Senior Software Analyst, Bloomberg Intelligence, joining us here in our studio. And of course, Anurad Rana, Senior Tech Analyst for Bloomberg Intelligence. He's out in Chicago. Breaking down what's happening in the world of technology, apparently Salesforce, the rumored discussions between Salesforce and software company Informatica cooling off here. So we're seeing the Informatica stock down a little bit today. We thank both of those guys for bringing us up to speed here.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Coming into today's trading, the S&P 500 was down roughly 5% off of its recent high. And a lot of folks were just saying, hey, is this a bump in the road? Is this the beginning of a sustained drawdown, which may or may not be healthy for this market longer term? That's some of the questions we've been hearing from a lot of the smart folks who cover these markets. Sylvia Jablonski joins us. She's the Chief Executive Officer and Chief Investment Officer at Defiance ETFs. Sylvia, how do you view the trading we've seen over here over the last week and a half here, this 5% pullback in the market? How does that kind of strike you in terms of the overall market behavior?
Good morning. Well, it's been a painful couple of weeks, that's for sure. I think that some new headwinds came into the market, right? That kind of weren't there before. We came out of the gate really strong. The inflation readings were looking, kind of good and solidly pointing downward. And then, we got some hotter than expected factory number, jobs numbers, CPI, and things like this recently. And so I think that until we get the data going back in the direction that we want it to, which is essentially, coming in below estimates and downward on inflation, and then we start to feel the security of the Fed potentially cutting this year again, whether it's one or two times, and, kind of just knowing that the Fed put is still in play, right? And that we're not going to turn around the other way. I think that'll help the markets turn around. And then I think the other thing that, is sort of trepidatious for investors is geopolitics. I mean, there's some, notable things going on in the world right now that I think really rocked markets over the last week and a half. And then I think that there's a need for kind of knowing what happens next there. But in terms of like the fundamentals and the macro picture, I'm still very constructive and bullish on the market, provided that those things, don't surprise us out of left field.
How about on the earnings front here? We're just kind of another real busy week here for the S&P 500 earnings. What do you think this market needs to see? I mean, how dependent? I mean, I know obviously earnings matter, but it seems like this is a market that's been pushed around by the Fed one way or the other here. What are you looking for in earnings at this cycle?
So, I mean, I guess the good thing about earnings is over the past couple of weeks or so, a lot of analysts have revised their earnings expectations downward. And so I think that, beats are going to be easier to come by. In terms of earnings, we live in this world now where the Mag 7, maybe we've subtracted Tesla from that list, or you know, a couple of names here and there, but the top tech companies, let's call it, as well as Nvidia, are really, you know, names that investors want good news from. And so then I think if they deliver, that tends to broaden the rally, and that tends to lift stocks in other sectors. You know, bank earnings haven't been so bad, right? And we haven't seen kind of this you know, recent rally from that news. So it's really those names that I think that have to perform. So I'll be looking at that.
So, you know, one of the big themes last year and coming into this year was AI, and obviously Nvidia and all those types of things. We saw some pretty violent action on Friday, some of those names kind of coming down. Was that kind of a technical move for you, or do you feel like the bloom is kind of coming off the rose a little bit on some of those AI-driven thematic names?
So I think that this is, you know, I always talk about like buy on the dip opportunities. This is it. I mean, I think that with some of the top names, if you're looking to get invested in AI or quantum computing, and, you know, you're a stock picker, you're an ETF buyer, these 5 to 10% recent pullbacks in some of these top names are really good opportunities to get back in. You know, AI innovation isn't going anywhere. It's just in the beginning. It's in its infancy. And when you think about when other companies and sectors start talking about how AI has transformed what they do, whether it's the defense sector or, you know, banks talking about better risk mitigation, pharmaceuticals talking about more efficient drug discovery, price discovery, you know, more effective surgeries in the healthcare system, things like this, you know, you're going to start to see how compelling it is to continue to buy these stocks as that innovation builds out. And, you know, we're barely scratching the surface with supercomputing and quantum computing too. So when you have all of this data, it has to be processed quickly. And in order for that to happen, you're going to have to kind of like buy up supercomputers and quantum computers and things like this too. So I just think that it's a great time to get back in, or get in if, you know, if you've kind of had FOMO. Even though the stock prices are high, they have pulled back.
What's the, I guess, you know, at Defiance ETFs, where are you guys seeing the fund flows these days?
Yeah, so two places, three places really. So we see a lot of flows into target income funds. So the investor that just likes to have that, you know, double digit monthly return at the end of the month and have broad-based index exposure. So we see a lot of flows into our SPYT and IWMY off of investors that want dividends. But I would say the fund that people are talking about the most and has kind of grown the most, even though it's been around kind of the longest, is quantum. And that's the AI and machine learning, what we were just talking about. You know, I think a lot of investors realize that NVIDIA and AMD, while they own those stocks, there's got to be something else. They don't necessarily know who the winners are going to be, or who that something else, what that something else is. And so they like the, you know, equal weighted basket of 70 stocks that are covering semiconductors, graphics, you know, technology, computers, cloud, cyber, things like this. And so we've seen a lot of interest there from investors.
How about on the fixed income side? I mean, are you seeing money flow in? Because, I mean, you can sit there at a two-year treasury and get close to the 5%. I know some folks were saying in some ETFs, they were seeing, like the folks at BondBlocks, for example, who focus on ETFs, seeing a lot of fund flows into there. Are you seeing that as well?
Yeah, and so when the market pulls back, I mean, we definitely see that. We don't see that on our side. We don't really have those types of products. But when you see that, it's usually, you know, it was years of inflation that was too high and stocks that just weren't running, like a 2022 tech recession, where you're going to put your money and get 5% treasuries made sense. But I would argue that this year is different. And those trillions of dollars that are sitting in those products and on the sidelines, I think will eventually make their way back into the market. You know, yes, we've had a 5% pullback, but look at broad-based equity performance this year. I think you'd rather be invested there than you would in treasuries. And I think that that'll slowly start to, you know, revert back into the markets, particularly if we get, you know, a broadening of performance in the markets. But for now, you know, market pulls back, you have geopolitical risk, you have, you know, a Fed that's kind of, you know, less iffy about those rate cuts and things like that. And so investors tend to flee to safety.
You know, Sylvia, I know one of the names on your list, and we've talked about it in the past, is IBM. In the world of AI or in quantum computing, where does the likes of a IBM play?
Yeah, so it's so funny because I think, and we talked about this before too, it's almost like that sleeper tech stock, right? Just what happened to IBM? And I would say that they're back, you know? I mean, they were always here. They had Watson. They're sort of the first you know, true AI play, I think, but they just weren't kind of known for it, I guess. And now they're coming out of the woodworks because they're doing so much work in quantum computing and supercomputing, and they're, you know, kind of providing services to Fortune 500 companies using their AI technology, but then they're also building and scoping out quantum computing. So they have deals with Cleveland Clinic to you know, create better drugs and pharmaceutical discovery processes. They have a project with Korea Quantum where they're looking at, you know, more precise information around aerospace and defense, and then also, you know, military types of logistical projects that they're working on. And, you know, you think about the US government pumping money into, you know, kind of defense and quantum computing and AI as it relates to that, you're going to see IBM have a good seat at the table, I think, in the future.
All right, Sylvia, thanks so much for joining us. Always appreciate getting a few minutes of your time. Sylvia Jablonski, Chief Executive Officer and Chief Information Officer of Defiance ETFs.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Last week, Alex and I were at the Bloomberg BNEF conference. That's New Energy Finance. These are the folks that really look at the energy space in depth, including all the new energy businesses that are being created across the world, really looking at it from the business perspective of global energy. They had a great conference last week in New York, some really smart people there talking about some of the bigger picture issues and what's getting done on the ground. David Daugherty joins us here today. He's head of oil and renewable fuels research at Bloomberg BNEF here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio. So, David, great conference you guys had last week. I learned a lot because I'm not an energy geek like Alex is, so I learned a lot here. Just by and large, what's the view of the big energy companies here in the U.S. towards making that migration to maybe greener energy? How committed are they? How long of a path do you think this will be for global energy?
Yeah, long path regardless, whether you're European or American and an oil producer. Completely different angles. U.S. companies have gone into sort of a cleaner molecule when they're willing to invest in low carbon tech. So think of like renewable fuels, CCS, hydrogen. Yeah. And the Europeans have pretty much piled into a bit of everything, but a lot of clean electrons, wind, solar, batteries, EVs. Very different cultures. You know, Europe doesn't produce as much oil as the US. So, you know, default position makes sense, I think.
Are you surprised just looking at, I'm looking at Brent crude here. You've got your Irish accent. I'm assuming you look at Brent more than my WTI crude oil. Just under $87 per barrel. I can make a case that it should be a lot higher, given what's going on in the world, in the Middle East, in Ukraine, with Russia and so on. What's going on in energy markets these days?
Yeah, everybody's looking at $100, right? Three digits that eyes are sort of focused on. The market's just completely different to the way it used to be, right? If you had an attack on Iran 5 years ago, you would have seen $15 upside on the price. The market's, one, smarter. We've satellites, we can track things. We've got people like Bloomberg, you know, counting ships going in and out of regions. Yep. But also the market was braced for it. It wasn't news, right? It wasn't, I guess. We were expecting something to happen. The price was built in. We've had a couple of months of sort of like anxiety around the oil price, what could happen to fundamentals. And then it was a bit anticlimactic, I guess, in the end.
So, I mean, I guess what's changed, just we were talking about it in the break here. I mean, just in the blink of an eye, it seems like the United States has gone from a big, big net importer of oil to now being a pretty big net exporter of oil. What does that mean for the global markets? Does that mean we don't have to worry about OPEC or any of those guys?
Absolutely have to worry about OPEC and those guys. Okay. Yeah. I mean, if you look at the world of sanctions, about just over the amount of Saudi Arabia in exports is now sanctioned. Venezuela, Iran, and Russia, right? That's huge. You're taking, let's say, the equivalent of the biggest producer that's falling under a form of sanctions. US produces a bunch of oil, yes, but it's not the right kind of oil for the US, so it's got to swap it out into the market. you know, because
it's
too
lighter crude.
Yeah, exactly. Where you've got really great refineries here that are built for Venezuelan Mexican oil, right?
Okay.
So there's this swap happening, and then if you bring in sort of disruptions around the Straits of Hormuz, etc., any disruption in shipping adds backlog into the whole, you know, the pipeline of how to get oil from A to B where it's needed. So the market's changing, the disruptions are changing. The U.S. is a big producer, and we've seen that make up for some of those OPEC cuts in the last couple of months. But absolutely still got to pay attention to what OPEC's doing and those big sanctioning exporters.
Well,
for sure.
Let's go to the sanctions. I mean, I don't know anything about the energy market other than what Alex Steele tells me, but it just doesn't seem like sanctions really work on it. The oil finds its way around, whether it's from Russia to India, India refines it, and then it ends up in my car in New Jersey. I mean, how does the sanctions work from your perspective?
I think they're probably working the way they were intended to this time, but this sort of round of sanctions on Russian oil is just meant to be different to those on Iran, right? If you think about Iran, it was like stop exporting, stop producing. They want to contain it. We saw obviously volumes get to China, about 1.5 million barrels a day go to China from Iran, right? So pretty big. Russia, the idea was not to shock the market, right? By taking this big, big exporter off of the market, about 4 million barrels per day exported out of Russia. That's huge, right? Much bigger than Iran. Election year, they don't want to rock the boat too much. Gasoline prices, even when you're seeing EVs in California breach like 20% of sales, you tell your average person on the street that and they'll say, why is my gasoline gallon so expensive, right? Super sensitive. Election year, US people like to drive. You don't want to have that taken out of the pocket, right?
All right, so as you sit back and take a look at your histories with oil, trading oil, all the distillates, all that kind of stuff, you're from, you know, you're kind of like John Tucker and I, we're kind of old energy people, but you live in a world of new energy finance. How do you think, like if you, what are the NEF people saying 10 years from now, 20 years from now, what percentage of global energy supply will be, you know, lack of a better word, green versus kind of the fossil fuels? Is there a feeling that that could be material?
It will be material, but it's important to put into context what's growth versus what's currently existing, right? The world isn't slowing down in its energy consumption growth story. So you're seeing more green, but it's meeting a lot of that upside, that growth, right? You're still seeing a lot of fossil fuels in the mix that's way harder to displace. So you're seeing EVs being like really high percentage of sales in places like China, but you're still seeing healthy internal combustion engine sales in China, right? That growth in mobility demand in markets like that, it's just outstripping anything we can do to disrupt the sort of status quo of fossil energy.
So where's the argument today, which I've heard for 20 years, peak oil?
Yeah.
Is that even a concept, or is it because the world economy is growing that there always will be, I guess, increasing demand for oil? I don't know.
I mean, yeah, our house view is 2029, right? But it's, you know, it's modeling, it's scenarios.
Peak oil at 2029 in terms of demand.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. 2029. For every EV displaced, there's an airplane going into the sky, or demand for plastics. Some things are a lot easier to displace than others. But road is important. It's really interesting. It's 45% of all oil consumed is wheels on the ground, right? So this electric story that people sometimes shift off and say whatever, that's the one to watch, I think.
So, I mean, do you think that, like here, Tesla, the stock's down over 40% year to date. Some people think we've seen peak EV demand. What do you think? Because I know in other parts of the world, it continues to grow dramatically.
You know, that will get clicks in a headline, but realistically, that's the world is not just Tesla when it comes to EVs. And if you look outside of the US, there's a huge range of automakers piling into that. China, Europe, over 20% of sales. We're at the point, the US might not be, California is, we're at the tipping point. Some will go faster than others and some won't, right? There's a lot of growth there still in some markets.
Yeah, I mean, thanks to Matt Miller, I drove a test drive of the F-150 electric car thing. That is a beast, man. That is really cool. So I could see a bunch of the F-150 people switching over to electric. It looked great, drove great. Had huge power, so good stuff. We'll see how it goes. Tesla earnings after the close tomorrow, listening in that conference call. David Daugherty joins us here. Appreciate getting a couple minutes of his time. He's head of oil and renewable fuels research at Bloomberg NEF. That's New Energy Finance for the people that don't know. Joining us here in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.